KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon. This hour, President Trump's growing influence over cultural institutions. How might it change what people see or can't see? And a battle for a single state Supreme Court seat draws national attention and big dollars. A former intelligence officer and what he sees as the security risks of Signalgate. And Brian Ferry's new album, where the spoken words are backed by music he's been saving for decades.
Like most artists, I have lots of scraps, you know, kind of scrapbooks and sketches and things which you at some point develop into bigger things.
And first we have our newscast. Today is Saturday, March 29, 2025.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Authorities in Myanmar now say more than 1,600 people died in a 7.7 earthquake yesterday. It was so powerful, a building under construction collapsed in Bangkok, Thailand, 600 miles away. Michael Sullivan reports from Thailand that it's hard to get information because of the military government's restrictions. But he says it's not a good sign that the military is asking for help.
In past disasters, the military ignored offers of help or severely restricted it, most egregiously in 2008 when Cyclone Nargis struck, and Western nations offered to use their navies and helicopters to ferry in relief supplies. The military ignored them and slow-walked visas for foreign aid workers, and more than 140,000 people ended up dying. I think the military asking for help this time is probably a sign they realize just how bad the situation is.
Michael Sullivan reporting. Several countries have sent teams to Myanmar to help treat the injured and search for the missing. The D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals says President Trump can fire two members of independent agencies. The ruling comes after a lower court had ordered the members reinstated. NPR's Andrea Hsu reports.
President Trump fired National Labor Relations Board member Gwen Wilcox in January and Merit Systems Protection Board member Kathy Harris in February. Both were Democratic members of independent agencies that handle workplace-related complaints. Federal law says presidents can only fire members of those agencies for cause, like neglect of duty or malfeasance. And for 90 years, the Supreme Court has upheld those restrictions at agencies with multiple members, like the two in question. But the Trump administration says such restrictions are unconstitutional. The government says the president is accountable for what happens in the executive branch and therefore can control it as he sees fit. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
The FAA says it's investigating a close call between a commercial jet and a military plane near Washington yesterday. NPR's John Stempin has more.
In a statement, the FAA says Delta Airlines Flight 2389, an Airbus 319, was cleared for takeoff from Ronald Reagan National Airport yesterday afternoon. During ascent, at least one of four Air Force T-38 Talons apparently passed under the Delta jet. According to reports, the Talons were part of a flyover nearby Arlington National Cemetery. An onboard collision avoidance alert activated in the Delta cockpit. Air traffic controllers issued new flight instructions to the pilots, and all of the aircraft steered away. 2 months ago, 67 people died when an American Airlines flight on approach to Reagan National collided with an Army helicopter. That investigation is ongoing. John Stempin, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News. Ukrainian officials say their military shot down 94 drones over the eastern city of Dnipro last night. Officials say at least four people were killed and at least 19 others were wounded. The governor says an apartment building and several homes were set on fire. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports 69 drone decoys were also intercepted.
As always, social networks were active with Ukrainians in Dnipro posting video of the drone attacks on their city. Russia tries to overwhelm Ukraine's air defense systems by sending swarms of drones all at once. Other cities such as Kyiv, Kharkiv, and Sumy were also targeted. The attacks continue despite U.S.-brokered ceasefire talks between Ukraine and Russia. The U.S. Embassy in Kyiv estimates that more than 4,000 drones have attacked Ukraine during the month of March alone. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Dnipro, Ukraine.
Tens of thousands of people have gathered in Istanbul for another protest in support of the city's jailed mayor. Ekrem İmamoğlu, who's President Tayyip Recep Erdogan's main rival. The rally was called by Turkey's main opposition party, the CHP, that nominated him as its presidential candidate. The BBC's Emily Wither reports.
The leader of the opposition, Özgür Özel, had called the gathering as a show of support for Mr. İmamoğlu, who sits in solitary confinement in a high-security prison on the other side of the city. Mr. İmamoğlu's arrest on corruption charges has led to the largest demonstrations here in over a decade.
The BBC's Emily Wither reporting from Istanbul. And I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Joyce Foundation, committed to advancing racial equity and economic mobility for the next generation in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. This is NPR.
From NPR News, I'm Scott Simon. Wherever you live, it's likely that there's a theater or a children's museum near you that is being supported in part by the federal government. And if you've ever visited Washington, D.C., you may have been inside one of the free Smithsonian museums or attended a show at the Kennedy Center. Since President Trump took office a couple of months ago, his executive orders relating to gender and DEI, or diversity, equity, and inclusion, have had a profound impact on arts and culture. NPR correspondent Elizabeth Blair joins us. Elizabeth, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Scott.
Give us an overview, please, of all the changes.
The changes are many and they're ongoing. Let's start with something President Trump said this week at a Women's History Month event at the White House. It has to do with the Smithsonian American Women's History Museum, which doesn't yet have a physical building. New York Congresswoman Nicole Malliotakis recently introduced legislation to locate the museum on the National Mall. Here's President Trump.
And she is really working hard on this one. This is a passion for you and you're working. It's a big, beautiful. She said it's going to be a big, beautiful museum. Well, it has to be. If it's for women, it better be big and beautiful, or we're in trouble, right?
And Trump signed an executive order this week that said, in part, that the Women's History Museum will, quote, not recognize men as women in any respect.
Let's talk about that executive order, because, of course, the Smithsonian is a complex of museums. There's Air and Space, American Art, American Indian Museums, also the Cooper Hewitt in New York, and for that matter, the National Zoo. So what else does this executive order say?
The order says a lot. Are you ready? It says that the Smithsonian has, quote, come under the influence of a divisive, race-centered ideology, and that it promoted narratives that portray American and Western values as inherently harmful and oppressive. It also says that no future federal dollars can be spent on anything that degrades shared American values. It goes on to say that the Department of the Interior should take a look at federal monuments to make sure they don't, quote, perpetuate a false reconstruction of American history or include any other improper partisan ideology. And it calls for reinstating monuments. We don't know exactly what that means, but we presume he's talking about monuments that were torn down because some people found them offensive. After the murder of George Floyd, more than 150 Confederate symbols were removed across the United States. And neither the Smithsonian nor the Department of the Interior have responded to a request for comment.
President Trump also made big changes to the John F. Kennedy Center for Performing Arts, what's known as the Kennedy Center, made himself the chair of the board. Do we know what his vision is?
The Kennedy Center, as you know, has multiple theaters and puts on thousands of performances and events a year. Trump has said the building needs a lot of work, but that it has tremendous potential. He has hinted at a few things he'd like to see there, a production of Cats, for example. He also suggested Elvis Presley should receive a posthumous Kennedy Center honors. He has also said what he doesn't want.
We're going to make sure that it's good and it's not going to be woke. There's no more woke in this country.
The new leadership recently eliminated the Kennedy Center's Social Impact Office, which organized projects and free events for underserved communities.
Let's talk about the way President Trump uses that term woke, because it's now become a kind of code for disparaging efforts to make organizations more inclusive. Of course, it's often through art that people learn about different perspectives. How is the president's campaign against wokeness affecting the arts?
It's affecting the thousands of arts groups in every corner of the country that receive money from the National Endowment for the Arts, or the NEA. The ACLU is suing the NEA because the agency had told arts groups that they wouldn't be eligible for funding if they promoted what the Trump administration calls gender ideology, which they say is denying, quote, the biological reality of sex. ACLU attorney Vera Edelman says that language violates the First Amendment and also the 1965 law that created the NEA, which says in part the agency should encourage freedom of thought.
The law that created the NEA made clear that the only standards by which any application was to be judged was artistic excellence and artistic merit. And Congress also made very clear in discussing the creation of the NEA that it specifically was worried about and wanted to make sure that the NEA did not become basically a government propaganda arm.
Just a note here that NPR receives NEA grant money. Once the lawsuit was filed, the NEA removed that language from its guidelines temporarily, but they're making a final determination in mid-April.
Elizabeth, there must be so many different answers to this, but what are artists making of these changes?
I talked to Holly Bass, who is a multidisciplinary artist whose work often explores her life as an African-American woman. She says lots of artists who have applied for NEA grants or who would like to are confused about language that says you can't do anything related to diversity, equity, and inclusion.
I would really love if the language was made more plain. Do you mean that you can only tell the stories of white people? And if that's what you mean, that's what you should say. But as far as I'm concerned, as an artist, I am doing the most American thing possible by telling my American story, the story of my family, the story of my community, and I will continue to do that.
Elizabeth Blair, correspondent on the Culture Desk, thanks so much.
Thank you, Scott.
State election in Wisconsin next week has attracted an endorsement from President Donald Trump and $20 million from Elon Musk and groups with which he's associated. National Democrats say it'll be one of the first opportunities for voters to push back on the Trump administration. Early voting is surging. Fundraising has broken national records. The race is for one seat on the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Wisconsin Public Radio's Rich Kramer joins us now from Eau Claire. Thanks so much for being with us, Rich.
Good to be here.
Who's on the ballot?
So this is a matchup between conservative county judge Brad Schimmel, who served 4 years as Wisconsin's Republican Attorney General, and liberal county judge Susan Crawford, who previously worked for a Democratic governor and has represented Democrats and Planned Parenthood as a private attorney. The race is officially nonpartisan, but our state parties are heavily involved.
And why? Why all the money? Why all the national attention?
Well, it depends who you ask. Republicans say it's about preventing a liberal majority from redrawing U.S. House district maps in hopes of flipping two GOP-held seats. Democrats say it's about keeping a conservative court majority from shutting down lawsuits aimed at expanding abortion access. More broadly, though, this is the first statewide election since President Donald Trump was reelected, and both sides are framing it as a kind of a barometer of how people feel about his first months in office. The president held a tele-rally with Brad Schimmel Thursday night. Here's what he said.
You know, I know you feel it's local, but it's not. It's really much more than local. The whole country is watching.
And Democrats agree. Here's how the head of Wisconsin's Democratic Party, Ben Wickler, put it at a rally earlier this month.
We have this gift. We have this incredible privilege, which is that we get to organize, fight back, and win an election that sends a message to the world, to the country, to this state, and to ourselves. We have this moment.
Now, we noted that Elon Musk is a major donor in the election. Tell us about some of the other big donors, and what does that indicate about the race?
We've seen contributions from across the political spectrum. Liberal mega donors like LinkedIn founder Reid Hoffman, Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker, and George Soros have been backing Crawford's campaign. Schimmel has received donations from conservative mega donors Richard and Elizabeth Uihlein, along with recent U.S. Senate candidate Eric Hovde and others from Wisconsin. But when combined with his affiliated political action committees, Elon Musk is reportedly the single largest spender. It's worth mentioning Tesla is currently suing the state in a case that could make it to the court. It's to allow the company to sell cars here. And there's another legal battle Musk is involved with in Wisconsin. Just yesterday, the Wisconsin Attorney General filed a lawsuit aimed at blocking him from giving million-dollar payments to people who signed his petition opposing what he calls activist judges.
And I gather there's been an early surge in voting. What do voters you've talked to say about the race?
So earlier this week, we saw nearly twice as many early in-person absentee ballots cast than at the same point in Wisconsin's 2023 Supreme Court race. One voter I spoke with from Western Wisconsin, he's a Democrat, Logan Morningstar, said he's become more involved in state and local politics since Trump's reelection because he just doesn't like what he's seeing happening in Washington.
I didn't vote for an oligarchy. I didn't grow up in a country where we had kings. I grew up in a democracy where we had elected officials who serve the public and are meant to do what the public has interest in.
Republicans have said the election is about keeping a liberal court majority from blocking Trump's agenda. Republican door-knocking volunteer Angela Kretschmer of southeastern Wisconsin told me the goal is to get conservatives who voted in November to the polls on Tuesday.
So we just have to remind them, yes, now we took our federal government back. It's now time to focus on local.
And Scott, races in Wisconsin tend to be very close, and this one could be especially close.
Thanks so much, Rich Kramer in Eau Claire with Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you.
Thank you.
And you're listening to NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. Rescue efforts are underway in Myanmar after a powerful earthquake yesterday. Officials say more than 1,600 people were killed. It measured 7.7 and brought down a building under construction in Thailand, 600 miles away. Tens of thousands of people demonstrated in Istanbul today over the jailing of the mayor. He's considered the main political rival to President Tayyip Erdogan. and the top vaccine expert at the Food and Drug Administration resigned yesterday. Dr. Peter Marks says it's become clear the current Secretary of Health and Human Services, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., does not desire truth and transparency. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. A journalist was accidentally added to the Signal chat group discussing U.S. military attack plans on Houthi targets in Yemen. In the aftermath of that leak, revealed by Jeffrey Goldberg of The Atlantic, U.S. spy chiefs appeared before the Senate Intelligence Committee, and CIA Director John Ratcliffe denied any wrongdoing.
I used an appropriate channel to communicate sensitive information. It was permissible to do so. I didn't transfer any classified information.
That's been the position of the Trump administration, but what's been the effect in the shadowy arena of espionage? Stephen Cash is a former intelligence officer for the CIA and Department of Homeland Security. He also worked on the Senate Intelligence Committee staff of the late Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein. He's also a member of a group called the Steady State, more than 250 national security officials committed to protecting the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Thank you for being with us.
Happy to be here.
Was this a serious security break?
Short answer is yes. This is an example of the type of security breach that all intelligence officers and all military people fear could happen.
When you say an example, something done inadvertently or not even with the knowledge, or how so?
The damage of this kind of release of information, it doesn't really matter if it was done intentionally, negligently, recklessly. It's the effect, which is at least potentially catastrophic in the near term and could be extremely damaging in the mid and long term.
How so?
Well, in the short term, if somebody's listening, it's telling them where the airplanes are, where they'll be in the future, what they're going to do, how long they're going to do it, and how they're going to do it. And if you're looking to shoot down an airplane, that's the kind of information you want to have. But the implications can be long term. All of this network of interrelationships between intelligence and the military and diplomacy are based on trust. And if you're not sure that the information is being handled professionally and carefully, you can't trust. And that means you're going to have to second guess. You're going to have to take extra steps. And there may be things you can't do or won't be able to do because of that.
You're suggesting people won't be able to speak candidly, or at least will be reluctant to.
Well, within the bubble of the U.S. government, they're going to be afraid to talk candidly or accurately. And planning our operations overseas, if the team can't talk to each other and is worried that somebody will drop the ball, it makes it very hard to accomplish our aims. But it also makes it hard for the people outside of the U.S. government to share information or intelligence with us. It could be another nation or somebody who, just an individual who wants to share information with the United States government to prevent a terrorist attack or prevent some terrible event. It's going to make people think twice.
What about the argument that some in the administration have made that, look, the operation succeeded, so what's the damage?
Well, the men and women who make operations happen are the best in the world and the best ever. But they're not the only parts of the team, and the fact that nobody happened to pick this up is dumb luck. And, you know, the old expression, no harm, no foul, that doesn't count in this business. No harm, no foul is not a principle you want to organize your national security around.
Mr. Cash, as a former intelligence officer, are you worried now about our intelligence hierarchy and military operations?
Yeah, I am. I mean, I think there's going to be implications of this particular incident, but I think that's repairable. What worries me more is that this incident and the response to the incident doesn't make me feel comfortable that whatever the problems are going to be fixed, because I see the cavalier, amateurish way that this particular incident was handled. I'd feel a lot better if somebody said, okay, we messed up and we're going to look at it and we're going to fix it. But nobody, I don't see anybody saying that. In fact, the closest I get is we're going to keep doing whatever we please here. That really worries me.
Stephen Cash, former intelligence officer, thanks so much for being with us, sir.
Thank you.
18 top Trump officials were on the text discussing military strikes in Yemen, published by The Atlantic this week. Journalist was, of course, added to the group, and that included the vice president, the secretary of defense, the secretary of state, and a White House figure who is known for channeling the voice of President Trump, Stephen Miller, deputy chief of staff. And look at his role more broadly. NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez joins us. Franco, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
Let's begin. What did Stephen Miller say on this now infamous text chain?
Well, top administration officials were debating the timing of strikes against the Houthis in Yemen. And you saw Vice President J.D. Vance calling the timing a mistake. Then there was some back and forth, and then Stephen Miller chimes in. He basically overrides Vance and the others. He writes, quote, "As I heard it, the president was clear, green light." And according to the text chain published by The Atlantic, that basically shut down the debate.
Franco, what's the significance of Stephen Miller being on this thread to begin with?
I mean, it really shows influence and power. Now, look, he's deputy chief of staff. That is a very important role, but he is not cabinet level, at least not officially. I spoke to Ryan Williams, a veteran Republican strategist. He says Trump is clearly the decision maker, but that there is an active discussion among cabinet members and senior staff on how to implement his vision.
This text chain shows that Stephen Miller's perspective means quite a bit in this discussion, and his words may even outweigh those of some cabinet members.
Now, the White House told me Trump sees Miller as a critical asset for his second term. Stephen Chung, the communications director, said Miller has loyally stood by Trump's side for nearly a decade and has, quote, been able to channel President Trump's message and voice as a speechwriter on the campaign as well as at the White House, and has also helped shape his policies.
How did Stephen Miller rise to this position?
Well, I mean, he's one of the president's longest-serving advisors. He joined Trump during his first presidential campaign, writing speeches and often serving as a warm-up act on the campaign trail. And as Chung noted, he got a lot of experience putting Trump's thoughts and ideas into words on signature issues like immigration. Now, Jessica Vaughn is with the Center for Immigration Studies, a group that advocates for limits on immigration. She's known Miller since his time as a Senate staffer.
Not only does he have a very granular knowledge and expertise about the issue, he has a gift of expressing the justification for it, the reasons why this is important to do, and helping others, including the president, express that justification.
She noted Miller's involvement in Trump deciding to use an obscure wartime law called the Alien Enemies Act to deport a large group of Venezuelans who the administration says are gang members to a mega prison in El Salvador without due process. That's now tied up in the courts, but she credited Miller with getting it approved quickly so that at least a few deportation flights could get out.
And how does Stephen Miller approximate or channel the president's voice?
Well, I mean, if you just take that controversy over the deportation flights, the administration went through with the flights despite a court order saying to turn the planes around. Miller has really been outspoken on this, attacking the judge who blocked the flights for going too far. Here he is on Fox News just last week.
What this judge tried to do would have meant, if this ruling was accepted, that a single district court judge can direct the movements of every single aircraft conducting every single deportation of every single criminal and terrorist in the United States. It would collapse the entire immigration enforcement system.
Franco, how much of Stephen Miller's work seems to involve immigration?
Well, I mean, this is obviously a top issue for Trump, and Miller continues to be in the middle of it. He's been a key part of the strategy to overwhelm political opponents with all sorts of directives, including efforts to restrict birthright citizenship and designating Mexican drug cartels as foreign terrorist organizations. You know, he was also, remember, at the center of the most controversial policies of the first administration. You remember the chaos at the airports after Trump first issued a travel ban on Muslim-majority countries, or the zero-tolerance policies on immigration that led to 3,000 children being separated from their parents. But, you know, unlike so many other officials from Trump's first term who basically fell out of favor with the president, Miller not only survived, he actually returned with much more power and a more prominent role.
NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez, thanks so much.
Thank you, Scott.
And now it's time for sports. March madness continues to churn, but is it really mad? When Major League Baseball returns, Michelle Steele of ESPN joins us now. Michelle, thanks so much for being back with us.
Sure. Good morning, Scott.
It is that college basketball time of the year. Let's begin with the women's tournament. Every single number one seed is still there. Texas, South Carolina, USC, and UCLA. You know, but at some point they got to play each other. Who looks strongest?
You know, I implore listeners right now not to yawn at my answer, Scott, but I think the strongest team does indeed look like the defending champs, the South Carolina Gamecocks. They outlasted Maryland last night. They're in another Elite Eight. They look like the team to beat. But to me, there's the strongest team, then there's the most intriguing team, and that's UConn. And whether or not Paige Beckers is really going to leave that program without having won a national title. They play three-seed Oklahoma. And given how things have gone so far, they should take care of business. We'll see.
Men's side down to the Elite Eight, but also every number one seed remains. Auburn, Florida, Houston, Duke. Has March Madness? I mean, where's the madness?
I know, right? Where's the Loyola Chicago? Where's the San Diego State?
Yeah.
You get these wonderful Cinderella runs in March Madness that normally galvanize the whole tournament. But one big issue, at least according to some college coaches, is NIL and the transfer portal. And what happens there is you get these talented college players at smaller schools. They can basically hit free agency every year and a big payday by being recruited to a bigger school. Now, it's 1 year and one tournament does not a trend make. We'll see what happens next year, but I think something's got to happen, especially with the transfer portal, because I'm not sure it's great for the sport.
I think the nuns at Loyola, Sister Jean, can bring a couple of big recruits over.
Pray for college basketball.
Pray
Sister
for college
Jean.
Basketball. Look, opening week in Major League Baseball, everybody's talking about, can the dark star, the L.A. Dodgers, repeat? I want to suggest the Chicago White Sox are undefeated. after you know, setting the record for most losses in a single season with 121 last year. So what, they just turned it around, right?
Yeah, right. Tied for first in the AL Central, Scott. Look, it's only fair about, we talked about them a bunch last year after that no good, miserable 121 loss season. So it's only fair that we talk about them when they're up.
Yeah.
And you're right, they're undefeated. They have yet to lose a game this year. They're 1-0. Do I think they're going to turn it around this year? Maybe a little bit. You know, I don't think they'll hit rock bottom again and break another record for losses. But listen, they're in the middle of a rebuild. They traded away their best player, ace Garrett Crochet, in the offseason. Yeah. They added young guys who just, quite frankly, have not done much in the bigs. I think it's going to be a long season on the south side, Scott, but I hear the milkshakes at the ballpark are pretty good.
Yeah, what are they called again? Like, not earthquake. What are they called again? I was reading it. Your graham crackers?
Now, see, now you're putting me on the hot seat.
Okay, all right.
People are going to have to look it up, but they're amazing milkshakes.
They've got graham crackers and, I think, infield dirt
it's
in
like
them.
S'more. Right.
And they, cost $50. And anyway, NFL draft is coming up in a few weeks. A player from Florida made headlines this week.
Yeah. University of Florida defensive tackle Desmond Watson, 6'6". I get this, Scott, 464 pounds. And to put that in perspective, the 85 Bears' William Refrigerator Perry never topped 340 pounds. So this guy makes the fridge look like a toaster. Now, he didn't have great production in college, but his pro day sure opened eyes. He ran a sub-6-second 40-yard dash, has a 25-inch vertical jump, could see him as an intriguing selection in the later rounds here. The question, of course, is whether he would count as two draft picks or one.
He's a big boy. I was wide open for that. All right, I can't wait to see him play. Michelle Steele of ESPN, thanks so much for being with us.
You bet.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Many Haitians in Florida are scrambling after President Donald Trump canceled two Biden-era programs that gave them temporary legal status. Wilkin Brutus from WLRN in Miami looks at how some in the Haitian community are grappling with what comes next.
Congregants at the Notre Dame de Haiti Catholic Church in Little Haiti, Miami, are singing Glory to Our God in Heaven. Haitian Catholic priest Reginald Jamaoui has been with the church for 25 years. He has seen fewer people attend services recently.
If you look at the mass today, it's a mass that we have over like 1,400 people. We did not have even 1,000 people at that mass. That means people are in hiding, are running away.
He says President Trump's efforts to crack down on immigration and carry out mass deportations have affected the church's education and children's programs.
We are an adult school. We drop to 60 students from 261. The daycare center, I don't even know what those parents are doing with the children. They are in hiding.
The UN says politically motivated gang violence has killed over 5,600 people and displaced a million within Haiti. So the Biden administration extended Haiti's TPS until February of 2026. But Trump's Secretary of Homeland Security, Kristi Noem, set a new termination date for August. That applies to more than 500,000 Haitians. And even more could be affected by the recent cancellation of a separate humanitarian parole program. We reached out to DHS but have not received a response.
You know, the illegal immigrants have always been targeted.
This 39-year-old mother has been a Haitian TPS holder since 2021. We agreed not to use her name because she fears speaking out publicly could affect her immigration status.
We feel that anybody and everybody is suddenly illegal. You wake up and then you're suddenly illegal without doing anything illegal.
She studied law in Haiti and says she can't go back because of fear of violence and the crumbling Haitian justice system. So she feels in limbo.
So I feel like a lost package in the mail, trying to figure out and, you know, to see the best place to deliver that package.
So Haitians like her now have to make tough decisions.
People with children who are U.S. born are wondering, what are they going to do with these children?
That's Gypsy Metalis. She runs the Sunt La Haitian Neighborhood Center. It's a nonprofit servicing immigrants in Miami. She says supporting parents has become a challenge.
Do they make the difficult choice of leaving the child behind? And if that's the case, to make sure that they've got all of the necessary legal precautions in place to make sure that children would be protected and cared for.
Organizations representing Haitian and Venezuelan TPS holders filed a lawsuit earlier this month challenging the federal government's decision to end TPS earlier. Metalla says one argument should be the ongoing political violence.
We are recognizing the surreality of the situation because you're talking about potentially sending someone to a war zone.
She hopes the lawsuit is successful and gives Haitians more time to prepare for a possible return to Haiti. For NPR News, I'm Wilkin Brutus in Miami.
This is NPR News.
With the U.S. southern border effectively closed, some Latin American migrants are deciding to return home.
It will be just like a waterfall. People come from Guatemala to Nicaragua to El Salvador to Costa Rica to Panama.
But is Panama ready to handle a wave of reverse migration? That story and the latest political news Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. Rescue workers are pulling more bodies from the rubble in Myanmar after a powerful earthquake yesterday. It had a magnitude of 7.7. Officials say more than 1,600 people were killed. Israel launched airstrikes against Lebanon yesterday. Officials say multiple Hezbollah targets were hit in response to several rockets launched from southern Lebanon. Hezbollah denies responsibility for those attacks. And the FAA says it's investigating a close call near Washington, D.C. yesterday. A Delta Airlines jet was taking off when at least one of four Air Force jets passed underneath. Air traffic controllers issued new flight instructions. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. From FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds working to maximize the impact of charitable giving and to create customized philanthropic solutions. Learn more at fjc.org. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Ron Curry's new novel, The Savage Noble Death of Babs Dion, is set in a French-speaking section of Waterville called Little Canada. What's it like?
You would have said Little Canada had seen better days, except it never really had. Different days, sure, but not better. Everyone had more trouble than money when Babs was a girl, and everyone had more trouble than money now. People worked too hard for too little when Babs was a girl, and people worked too hard for too little now. Back then, beer and rot gut liquor flowed through the gutters. These days, it was heroin, and so on. Poor was poor and remained so, and the rest was just calendar dates and details.
That's Ron Curry, the author, and his character Babs Dion is a devoted grandmother, tough-loving mother, and she happens to be a mobster who controls the supply of drugs into Little Canada. But competition appears, and her youngest daughter, Sis, is found dead. It's the latest novel from Ron Curry. He's also a screenwriter and teaches at the University of Southern Maine. He joins us now from Portland, Maine. Thanks so much for being with us.
So great to be here, Scott. Thank you.
And Babs Dion is, at least in part, inspired by your grandmother?
She is. I've sort of been hedging my bets and saying that Babs is a tribute to the spirit of my grandmother. Lest anybody should think that my grandmother was actually a criminal. She wasn't, but she was pretty gangster. And as such, I thought that she would serve as a good template for a character like this.
Yeah. I made a note of one of your phrases. We said of Babs, if you loved like she does, it would break you.
Mm. That was my experience of Franco women in general when I was a kid. The phrase that I've been using that's not in the book, but I like it a lot, is that they have molten love where their bone marrow is supposed to be. And it was very much a matriarchal environment that I grew up in by simple dint of the fact that the men were never around. They were either at work, at the bar, or in their graves. And as such, women ran the show. And that's why Babs and her girlfriends in the book, you know, they run the rackets in Waterville and they have bent local politicians and the police department to their ends. It's just sort of an extension of the matriarchal control that I experienced as a kid in that community.
There's a horrifying event in Babs's past and early in the novel when she's 14, a rape and murder.
Mm-hmm.
She has blood on her hands, if not her conscience. A priest comes through in a surprising way, doesn't he?
Yeah, Father Clement. Father Clement does what the church used to do during that generation and before. When somebody got into trouble, the church made them disappear under certain circumstances, just spirited them away, basically, right? That's what Father Clement does for Babs. And then she comes back 5 years later when the heat's off. And that's really the moment when she sort of claims her crown. The story of what she did to the cop has, of course, become legend in her absence. Mm. And the idea that somebody is almost supernatural in their ability to control things and should not be crossed.
Babs, if we may, stabbed a police officer who assaulted her.
Yes, that's right.
You sort of see Babs Dion as kind of a generational link in a chain of women that go back to 17th century France.
Like many of us Franco-Americans, we're descended from a relatively small group of women who were known as the King's Daughters. And they were brought to what was then New France, what we know as Canada now, for the sole purpose of populating the colony. They took a bunch of women who didn't have much in the way of prospects otherwise and brought them here to be incubators. And in the book, the sort of family line between one of those women and Babs is articulated at the very beginning. One of the central ideas in the book is sort of articulated through that process, the idea that we're not discrete, blank slate individuals, were actually the accumulation of all the choices that preceded us in life.
Well, tell us about Lori, her daughter, Babs's daughter.
The relationship between Lori and Babs is sort of classic in that they're cut from exactly the same cloth. They're equally tough. They're equally stubborn. And as such, they're working together and against each other, sometimes simultaneously.
And, of course, when we meet Lori, she's in the middle of, I'll get you to describe it.
When we meet Lori, she's dead. She's lying on the floor of a bar or bathroom, and she's just overdosed.
I have to ask, how can a, God bless her, a drug kingpin like Babs be surprised or even shattered when her own daughter becomes addicted?
That's a fair question. I don't think that she's surprised, but I do think that she is dismayed. I mean, Babs, I think, expects that her own kids will be as tough and principled and stoic as she is. And of course, nobody can be. Babs is supernatural in her self-control. She doesn't tolerate what she perceives as weakness in other people very well.
Tell us about the difference people in Little Canada see between American and Americain.
Yeah. It's an argument that Lori has with her own older brother on 9/11. Her older brother, Jean, immediately goes to enlist in the army. And Lori thinks, and Babs also thinks, that that's a terrible idea for any number of reasons, not least she and her people, Franco-Americans, were the Anglo establishment in the United States was happy to use them as plow horses, but they were never going to be given a fair shake in this society. And as such, Babs's attitude is, why would we fight for it? And that's, you know, to me, it's sort of a microcosm of the riddle of America, right? Like, we're all American and not all at the same time. And I think that makes for interesting interpersonal dynamics, but it also, as a nation, I think it makes us very powerful, but also sort of unruly and difficult to govern.
How did you like spending time in this world?
Oh, God. It was almost a relief, Scott, because that world that I grew up in is so completely gone now that there have been times, as I approach 50 this year, that I sort of have this sense that I made it up, that it never really existed. And of course it did, and I have confirmation of that everywhere if I want it. But it's sort of that part of my life, I'm so thoroughly anglicized and secularized now that it feels like a fantasy or a phantom limb, and it haunts me. And I wanted to be able to make a version of a record of that world before my memories were too fuzzy to do so.
Ron Curry's new novel, The Savage Noble Death of Babs Dionne. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott. My pleasure.
Sometimes songs take decades to grow and form.
Like most artists, I have lots of scraps, you know, kind of scrapbooks and sketches and things which you at some point develop into bigger things.
That's Brian Ferry, best known as a member of Roxy Music. I could feel formed in 1970, Brian Ferry as frontman and principal songwriter. He's kept cassettes of rough musical ideas and sketches from all of that time and is now releasing them on a spoken word album called Loose Talk. But much of the talking on this album isn't from Brian Ferry, it's from Amelia Barrett.
The theater is closed in the morning, but outside is a florist. So I watch him wrap stems in paper and twine. No gloves on.
The florist. It starts with, the theatre is closed in the morning, but outside is a florist. You know, all my texts have to start with a really strong first line. That's how I kind of get going. And from there, everything just kind of fell into place. I mean, the way I write is kind of collage fragments of observation, and it has this quite emotional arc to it. And it's one of the texts that is most like a story.
Imagine one day he comes home to me and says, "There is nothing more I want than this." He gestures to the tulips that look out from a bucket, bunched in the passenger seat of the van.
The way that it ends with the narrator in tears was not something that I really planned, but it seems to resonate with people, that one.
Where does a poem come from for you?
As an artist and a visual person and a painter as well, I notice things, and it's kind of my job to do so. So I start with a load of notes, things that I notice or observe, or sometimes occasionally fragments of speech. And then it really is, I often do think of it like collage. I lay everything down and go from there. And how it actually happens is kind of a bit unknown. But with the knowledge that they're going to be worked on by Brian, that's a great motivation, having so much respect for Brian's music.
Brian Ferry, how do you think your music has changed since the days of Roxy Music?
Well, it's been very freeing for me to work on this project and improvise and not be tied down by song structures and so on. I think as people do get older and mature, they become more reflective, and that's pretty obvious in some of the music on this album. I'm also very interested in the idea of collage, with collage of sounds, and that's always been my thing. I mean, from the first beginnings of Roxy Music, I always found that exciting. And on this project, you know, having these great poetic stories, which are kind of fragments of everyday life, but there's some mystery about them, and that's a kind of feeling I like to get from music too.
Chairs fixed to the floor. The youngest violinist wears a shirt with a cinched waist, looks out remorsefully from it. There won't be a dry eye tonight.
Do music and poetry, spoken word, both have the quality of making us really look deeply and see what's right in front of us and otherwise might not notice or just take for granted?
Certainly, I think poetry has that potential. Spoken texts have that potential. That's why I've always really liked working with that medium. It can take one, out of oneself slightly. But then the music, I don't know, I feel that there's more of a sense that one can lose oneself to a kind of other dimension. Maybe that's what's interesting about this combination of those two things.
Let me get you both to talk about the song Holiday.
A t-shirt fell upon me. A loose cloak. Surprise. I love a uniform. A holiday for the scattered mind. A pack of cards. 54 floats upon the water. Different costumes along the coast state one thing only. Frivolity. Yeah, I mean, the more that we were working on these tracks, I started to get excited about what I could do next that was different. They had been moody in a particular way, a bit more downbeat and kind of gritty and industrial. I remember feeling like I wanted to write something that had sunshine in it, the squeal of delight, and then an aside. I do not wish to count all the times we have missed an opportunity to just live life.
It felt very fresh when it came, that one, and it was kind of uplifting and yet quite intense in a funny way. And then there's a certain stateliness about it as well, which I somehow feel.
This is a wonderful collaboration. I wonder if it makes both of you think about more collaborations.
Yeah, well, we're well on the way through the second album, actually.
It's very exciting, and I think we've found a way to work, which is we can both kind of work quite intensely in our own way. I think in a collaboration, that's really the dream, where you don't have to talk about what you're making, you're just making. You've found some common ground, and there is a kind of trust there.
Yeah, we don't seem to get in the way of each other, as it were. It's really good. proof is in the pudding.
Lights out. Take the lights out of this blinking head. Deep belief blossom, so as to split the shell, spill, drop out and down, sink. Like ink in an oil tank.
Brian Ferry and Amelia Barrett talking about their new album, Loose Talk. Thank you to both of you for being with us.
A pleasure.
Thank you for having us. Lay back. The seats are leather. Lay back. It's over. And with the mist lifted, a sigh so natural, your own company. So good you don't know that you're in it.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
And in your ear, from the rafters, loose talk.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Progressive Insurance with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From the Cy Sims Foundation, partnering with organizations and people since 1985, working for a better and more just future for all. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
you can swing it soon.
Ooh, wah, blah, blah, blah.
You can chime in on the jive, jive, jive.
Ooh, wah, blah.
It's a simple riff.
Ooh, wah, blah.
Ooh, with an easy lift.
Ooh, wah, blah, blah.
That's the rhythm of the jive, jive, jive. You have to dig this tempo. Ooh, don't let it get slow. Beat on out on that jive, Joe. Stop. Start to jive again.
Ooh, wah, blah.
Now you got the stride.
Ooh, wah, blah.
Ooh, you can really ride.